rental car, who appeared to be working at the mosque. Crimmins had worthless capture high-resolution stills and video of the new person of interest and forwarded those to Masada higher headquarters. Hours later, the Masada surveillance detail received a report and were told to continue shadowing their primary target. Tonight, Reese's Land Cruiser was not in the hotel parking lot. It was parked just down the street. That put Crimmins on edge. In Iraq, Crimmins had noticed similarities between how their ground intelligence teams had developed target packages and how his uncle had taught him to hunt whitetails in the Tennessee of his youth. Humans and animals were creatures of habit. It was all about identifying patterns. He'd been involved in enough surveillance details at home and abroad to know what Reese was doing. He was hunting. Chapter 24. Reese waited in darkness. He'd wetted down the dead air Odessa 9 suppressor with water from the bathroom sink to further dampen the sound. The suppressor was threaded onto the true precision barrel of his SIG P365. Contrary to what Hollywood had programmed moviegoers to think, silencers didn't actually silence a gunshot. Rather, they suppressed the noise to more palatable levels, which is why the military community called them suppressors, in contrast to Hiram Maxim's original patent language, which called them silencers. Reese planned to take one well-aimed headshot as his target entered the room. No plan survives first contact with the enemy, Reese. That's why you have more than one round. Be prepared. Reese glanced at the vintage Rolex Submariner on his wrist. Any time now. At the sound of a woman's voice, Reese jerked his head from his watch. What the fuck? I know I'm in the right room. Bolting from the chair in the corner, Reese bounded past the bed and peered through the peephole before quickly retracting and throwing his back against the wall in the dead space behind the door. Shit! Sohrab Behzad had a woman with him. Reese's mind raced. Take a breath and make a call, Reese. The former frogman pulled his pistol down against his abdomen into the Sul position to get as flat as possible. Sul was Portuguese for south, and had been developed in Brazil as a way to move more safely through crowds with a handgun without drawing the type of attention one would otherwise generate at the low ready or high port. Right now, Reese used it in an attempt to melt into the wall as the door swung open on its automatic commercial closer. Shit! Before the door had even shut, to give Reese the time he needed to bring the pistol up for a shot, Sohrab had grabbed the woman and pulled her through the small entry toward the bedroom. He tore off her leather jacket as he spun her around and drove her toward the bed. Had he not been distracted by her artificially enhanced breasts, he might have taken the time to professionally assess the room. Sohrab was thinking with his dick. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast. Emerging from his position against the wall, Reese moved into the bedroom, slowly working to get an angle that wouldn't endanger the woman. Her jacket was on the floor and her tight top was pushed up, revealing a lacy bra that struggled to contain her tits. She had Sarab's full attention. His left hand held her head to his face buried in the side of her neck, his other hand forcing its way down the front of her tight skirt between her legs. That attention shifted in an instant when the woman opened her eyes and screamed. A creature had materialized from the entryway, a creature holding a gun. Sohrab spun, instinctually throwing the girl at the threat. No shot. Reese retracted his pistol to a position of retention and deflected her momentum with his forearm, sending her crashing into the closet. Win the fight. Reese charged forward, driving his opponent face down onto the bed, still attempting a single shot to minimize the risk of discovery. Holding him down with his support hand, Reese struggled to index his muzzle on the back of his adversary's head, which would have worked on an untrained opponent. It didn't work on Sohrab. With a violent twist, Sohrab threw Reese off balance, elbowing him in the side of the head and pushing him back off the bed, just as Reese's trigger finger sent a shot into the mattress. The mosque security man was now in his element, using a leg sweep to take Reese to the ground between the wall and the bed. Falling to the floor with his attacker, Sarab pinned Reese's pistol to the wall by the suppressor while raining down a succession of hard blows with his free hand. Covering his head with his left hand in an attempt to counter the hits, Reese drew his left knee up and to the inside, creating space as Sarab went for the mount. That was the opportunity Reese needed to draw his blade from appendix carry with his left hand in a reverse grip and stab it directly into Sarab's groin. He retracted it quickly and thrust it into his target's diaphragm. Feeling the sharp intrusion, Sarab's body reacted. His hand loosened on the pistol he still had pinned to the wall, allowing Reese to rip it back and fire two rapid shots. The first went into Sarab's leg just above the kneecap. The second went into his upper thigh, tearing through muscle, sinew, and bone, with the largest bullet fragments finding their way into his hip. Desperately wanting to get out from underneath the surprisingly heavy man, Reese thrust his pelvis up and to the side, sending his target forward and smashing his head into the bedside table. Aggressively turning to get to his feet, Reese moved to cover by the closet, pushing the still screaming woman back toward the entryway and sending two more shots at the man, who now had a pistol in his hand. Where the hell did that come from? Sarab took one of Reese's bullets to the groin and another to his lower abdomen while shooting three rounds into the wall as Reese disappeared into the entryway. The sound of the unsuppressed pistol was deafening in the small space. Shit, I hope that didn't kill anyone sleeping next door, Reese thought. End this. Preparing to get the angle and put Sarab down, Reese felt the flurry of blows from behind. He spun, obstructing the girl's punches, first knocking her to the closet and then kicking her into the bedroom. The force of the kick sent her flying past Sarab, who fired two shots at the movement, both of which missed and again impacted the wall. Taking advantage of the misdirection, Reese went to a knee to change levels. Emerging from cover, he put two well-placed shots into Sorab's upper thorax. Pouncing from the kneeling position, Reese closed on the man who had helped facilitate 9/11. With the blade still in his support hand, he stabbed Sarab in the hip, exploding upward and opening the left side of Sarab's body from his pelvis to his chest. With his knife embedded in his enemy's deltoid, he used his elbow to check Sarab's gun offline, trapping him at the door of the bathroom across from the bed. Moving the suppressor of his pistol under the wounded man's chin, Reese looked him in the eye and pulled the trigger. Chapter 25. Ali Ansari was fulfilling his due diligence. Of all the assets in place across the United States, he had the most specific information on Sarab Behzad. The man worked for the Islamic Relief Society of America and had been in and out of mosques developing security plans for almost 20 years. According to the file, Sarab came from a devout Islamic home. The family had disowned his sister years ago. Lucky for her, she didn't live in Afghanistan. Ali knew that when she left the world of the living, she would spend eternity in the fires of Al-Nar. In fact, Jahannam might be the next place the siblings were reunited. Ali pulled his car to a stop across the street from the extended stay hotel. He'd tailed Sarab from the hotel to the mosque to dinner at the home of the imam, and then into an area of the city one wouldn't want to spend much time in unless it was absolutely necessary. Ali wondered why Sarab didn't pick one of the more upscale gentlemen's clubs in Atlanta. 2 hours later, Sarab exited and picked up a woman by the back entrance. It was not difficult to discern that she was a whore, just like his sister. No matter. Sarab would soon be dead. They had an appointment in Briarwood Park the following day. There, Ali would pass on the Marburg dispersal device, along with the vitamin D tablet antidote. Atlanta would suffer the same fate as Denver. Ali was about to start up his car and return to his hotel, his curiosity satisfied, when he heard the gunshots. Instantly alerted, he focused his attention back on the four-story establishment. His breathing intensified as he wondered what was happening and if he should get out of the area before the police arrived. Catching movement in his peripheral vision, he watched as a side door swung open and a man and woman swiftly moved into the dark wooded area just south of the hotel. The woman was the same one who had entered with Sohrab, but the man was someone new.
"What is this?"
The man kept his head down but was obviously alert, his arm around the woman who stumbled along next to him. Ali took pictures with his cell phone before they vanished into the darkness. For a moment, Ali didn't know whether to follow the man and the whore, stay observing the hotel to find out what happened to Sohrab, or turn tail and put as much distance between him and the gunshots as possible. Trusting his instincts, he hit the start button and eased into the night. As his headlights illuminated his marks, Ali was careful not to change speed. He passed them, getting into a Land Cruiser. Had it been a different car, Ali might not have noticed, but it was a vehicle prevalent in the land of his upbringing, and not so prevalent in the United States. He had also seen it before, outside the house of Karim Talib in Chicago. Ali's heart raced faster than his mind. A nervous sweat caused him to take a tighter grip on the wheel, his eyes darting to the rearview mirror and out the side windows looking for any sign of the American FBI. If law enforcement were on to him, they would not have allowed him to pass the device to the assets in Texas and Colorado. Were they following him? Was he leading them to the entire cell? Had all his hard work been for nothing? No. The Americans would have stopped him. This was something different. Ali drove exactly the posted speed limit, watching the cars around him. He pulled into a gas station on the outskirts of the city. He still had a mission. He carefully screwed a time-release mechanism onto the virus dispersal device and left it in an overflowing trash can. It would not be as effective as what Ali had originally planned for a local hospital, but in this business one had to adapt. The cold perspiration continued to intensify until he pulled into a motel just over the Alabama border. Acting as naturally as possible, he checked in and went to his room. He requested one with a view of the parking lot and immediately parted the drapes at the window, half expecting to see a fleet of American police cars descend upon him. He opened his Biodyne work computer and selected a VPN. He then entered a username and password for a photo-sharing account, activating a protocol to be used only in the case of extreme emergency. Via Bluetooth, he shared the photos he'd taken of the man and the hooker as they exited the hotel, along with the video he'd taken as he passed them in the street. He uploaded both to the photo-sharing service and into an album of innocuous photographs of national parks, flowers, mountains, and monuments. Photos that looked like any other photo-sharing account, storing vacation memories. Why had the Land Cruiser been at the location of two of Ali's assets? Surely the Americans would have used a more innocuous vehicle for a professional surveillance detail. The fact that Ali had not been arrested suggested that something else was at play. As per their prearranged procedures, Ali's uploaded photo and video to their shared database meant there was a problem. If Ali uploaded a photo, the receiver knew it was a picture of someone who threatened the mission, someone who had to be eliminated. Hafez Qasem received the alert that new photos had been uploaded to the shared account the following morning. An hour later, he had confirmation that the man in the photo was a former commando with an interesting history. Qasem had a face, a name, and a vehicle. If Ali had risked sending the photo, he needed the man dead. Qasem hit a button on his desk phone, summoning an assistant who appeared a moment later. The Iranian intelligence chief was about to activate a sleeper cell on American soil. By the end of the day, a team of assassins would have orders to kill James Reese. Part 2. Infection. Marghbar, Amerika, Death to America. Ali Khamenei, Iran's Supreme Leader. Chapter 26. Camden, North Carolina. Eric Sawyer finished reading the report for the fourth time and tossed it onto his desk, leaning back in his Wegner swivel chair and interlacing his fingers behind his head.
Lieutenant Commander James Reese, what are you up to?
Save for the lavish chair, his office as founder and CEO of Masada Security Solutions was no different than the nine other offices that dotted the administration building of the largest paramilitary training facility in the United States. Just across the Virginia border in North Carolina, Masada's 8,000-acre flagship compound boasted indoor and outdoor shooting ranges, a driving track, a lake for waterborne insertion operations, two sniper ranges, an airfield, kill houses, a maritime interdiction trainer, and a multipurpose canine complex. They also had constructed what they called the Tactical Training Laboratory, a huge, state-of-the-art indoor facility housing multiple buses and airplane fuselages. Lighting, audio, fog, and temperature could be configured from a control room that filmed the practice runs for later debriefings and assessments. They even had a 150-foot ship available to rent for visit, board, search, and seizure underway training docked in Norfolk. Located within driving distance for special operations units based in Fort Bragg and Virginia Beach and the FBI's hostage rescue team in Quantico, Virginia, Masada was a playground for the best operators in the world. It was also the headquarters of Sawyer's private army. Sawyer preferred his office to look just like those of the boys, the retired operators and spooks who ran the day-to-day operations of what had popularly become known as a PMC, or private military company. His employees were called contractors in Western parlance. The rest of the world called them mercenaries. Behind his back, he was disparagingly called the whore of war by those critical of outsourcing America's wars to for-profit companies. Sawyer wore the moniker as a badge of honor. He had purchased the property with a sliver of his inheritance after his return from Mogadishu. It had come a long way. The years following 9/11 saw an explosion of growth in the security sector, and Sawyer was positioned to pounce. He used the new influx of capital from overseas contracts to expand the North Carolina complex, also adding off-site facilities in California, Illinois, and Florida. Maritime, air, and intelligence divisions were run from offices in McLean, Virginia, near his most profitable clients, the U.S. Department of State and the Central Intelligence Agency. The privatization and outsourcing spurred on by the global war on terror had been good to Sawyer. The Spartan offices on the edge of the Great Dismal Swamp stood in stark contrast to the building in McLean, where politicians could stop by for bourbon, and military and intelligence officials could marvel at the impeccably decorated conference rooms and offices. Maybe there was an office waiting for them in retirement if they approved a multi-million dollar security contract. When Sawyer was in North Carolina, he wanted to train. He'd hit the obstacle course with a group from Quantico early that morning, impressing even the most fit agents in the group. When HRT moved on to the Tactical Training Laboratory to practice bus takedowns, Eric had challenged his COO of the training division to a shoot-off. The COO was a crusty master chief who kept the range schedule packed with well-paying clientele. He also happened to be on the streets of Mogadishu on October 3rd and 4th of 1993. They ran a stress course competition in full kit. Eric won the speed game but lost by 10 points when they scored their targets.
"Fast is fine," the master chief chided his boss, "but accuracy is everything."
"Wyatt Earp, I believe," Eric said, citing the attributed source of the quote.
Though he didn't mention it to the old SEAL sniper, Eric knew his first shots were on target well before those of the aging master chief. He counted it as a win. Originally incorporated as Talos, named for the bronze god who guarded the island of Crete. The company name had subsequently been changed to Masada, following the unfortunate 2005 Gardez incident. In Greek mythology, Talos had a weakness. An unprotected vein in his ankle held his ichor, the lifeblood of the gods. It was a reminder to Sawyer that even the most powerful and well-trained among them had flaws. The country had weaknesses, as did his company and each individual operator who now worked for him. The key was acknowledging those weaknesses and then taking steps to turn them into strengths. Rebranding his company after an incident on par with the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, he had chosen the name Masada for the great fortress in southern Israel overlooking the Dead Sea, a fortress